support against the West and the governments of Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Egypt, and others. His strategy is classic. Construct an external enemy to build internal political strength. Filled with 3 years of frustration, I could only continue to lecture. We must counter his strategy. Our focus should be on Al-Qaeda and their affiliates. We must define our enemy in very specific, very narrow terms. This is not a war of us against Islam. It's just the opposite. Our Muslim allies are the most important allies that we have. We must reach out to them, reassure them, empower them, and build alliances across the true Islamic faith. And not just with Muslim governments, but with Muslim institutions and leaders from all sectors. This conflict is against Al-Qaeda, a non-state actor. We must forge alliances with other non-state actors. We and our Muslim allies must defeat Al-Qaeda together. "Does that include Muslim clergy?" he asked. "Yes, sir." "And other Muslim leaders, government and non-government. We need them and they need us." We sat there in silence for a couple of minutes. "Our homeland has been attacked. We have been violated. But this is not just about us. We cannot do this alone," I added. In my years working counterterrorism, I had learned that our intelligence collection and our covert action depended on our Muslim allies and agents, and that our unilateral operations served as a critical complement. It was not either one or the other. It was a mix of multilateral, bilateral, and unilateral collection and action. Finding that correct blend would be necessary in this kind of war. The ambassador sat immobile. More silence. He glanced around my sparsely appointed office, then back at me. I wondered if he understood my perspective. As if reading my mind, he said, "Got it. Thanks." "Yes, sir." Within the next couple of days, the ambassador met with key Muslim leaders in the host country. He addressed an overflowing crowd of national politicians. He managed our national security relationship with our ally brilliantly, taking it to a new level. In September 2001, our allies surged all their resources to help. Signals intelligence, human source networks, foreign liaison relationships, and their military, including their special forces, who would fight valiantly in Afghanistan. The head of the intelligence service played a critical leadership role. He also provided me guidance and became a dear friend. The local public sentiment was overwhelming. The front embankment of the U.S. Embassy grounds was covered in wreaths and flowers, brought by allied citizens paying their respects. Over the next several days, while working with liaison, I wondered if HQS would call for my help. I considered volunteering to return to HQS or go to Afghanistan, but decided that was presumptuous. I had just arrived at my station, the start of an important tour, managing the intelligence partnership with one of our most important, valued allies. My assigned duty was here, and my ambassador was a good boss. Nevertheless, I hoped Kofor would reach out to me. I figured Director Tenet was in the middle of the policy debate, and CTC was supporting him. CTC knew more about AQ than any other entity in the government. The CTC role was crucial. The call came at home, late at night. Enrique Prado, who had replaced me in CTC, was on the other end of the line. He had arrived in the United States from Cuba in 1957 when he was 6 years old. After a stint in the U.S. Air Force, he joined the CIA's clandestine service and served bravely in the CIA covert wars in Central America during the 1980s. He had started working against AQ in 1996. Selfless and dedicated to the mission, he served his country with a burning passion. "This is Rick. Get to the office. Call me on the secure line," he said. It took me 5 minutes to drive there, 5 minutes to clear the guard post and access the station spaces. The secure phone connection was clear. Kofar asked me to call. This is not an order, this is a request. We are going into Afghanistan. He wants you to organize and lead the war. Director Tenet has approved it. I don't need an answer right now, but soon. Think about it. Rick laid it out in his crisp, clear, succinct way. He spoke just as he ran his operations, with focus and discipline. When do you want me back? You can think about it. I already have. When? Okay. Get here as soon as you can, but take care of your family first. I'll book a flight and let you know. Tell Kofar thanks. Yeah, and Hank, all of us here, we knew your answer. I secured the office and walked out of the building. The cold slapped me in the face. The wind was blowing. I looked at our large flag, flying at half-mast, whipping strongly in the breeze and illuminated brightly by the spotlights. I looked away from the flag and surveyed the sky. It was clear. The stars flickered. I stared into the expanding universe, which had just gotten bigger. Turning back to the flag, I prayed with eyes wide open and with an intensity that hurt. Dear God, bless those victims who have died in this tragedy. Bless their families. Please give me strength and wisdom. I need you. Be my guide. Watch over my family. Watch over the men that I will lead into war. Help us destroy this evil enemy. Amen. At that moment, the only thing that matched my faith was my hatred for Al-Qaeda. I wanted to kill them all. The CIA and the President would afford me that opportunity, honor, and privilege to serve our nation and destroy our enemies, well beyond my boldest boyhood dreams. Headquarters. A few days later, I landed at Dulles Airport. It was early evening. I grabbed a rental car and drove straight to HQS. After clearing the main security gate, I parked in somebody's reserved spot, tabbed my way through the main entrance, and headed for CTC. The CIA's first command center for the Afghanistan War was a tiny, windowless room filled with maps, photos, books, and stacks of paper. It looked like the office of an associate professor at a small, poorly funded liberal arts school rather than a covert action war room. Four of us gathered around a map of Afghanistan: Frank, the strategist, Jack, the analyst, John, the deputy, and me. The previous week, I had picked John Massey as my deputy. This was one of my best decisions of the war. While still overseas, I asked Prado for a list of potential deputies. He mentioned that John Massey might be available. "I know John. He's a great guy, but didn't he retire?" I asked Prado over the secure line. "He changed his mind on 9/11. He ignored the order to evacuate HQS and instead came to CTC to help. He's now in New York. He's digging through the rubble." The director had ordered everybody to evacuate HQS immediately after the attacks. Kofar defied the order, telling the director that CTC was excluded. All in CTC would stay at their post. John also ignored the director's order. Instead, he shelved his retirement and made his way to CTC and volunteered. John and I had spoken in the hallway of CIA HQS earlier that year. He told me about his post-government plans. He and his wife, Linda, were moving to the Southwest to buy and run a dude ranch. He had been a U.S. Park Service ranger in his youth. His wife was an accomplished rider. This was their dream. They wanted to earn a living on horseback. "Digging through rubble?" I echoed. "You want him?" Prado asked. I quickly ran through my mental file on John. He was a graduate of the Naval Academy. He was a great athlete, having competed in the NCAA National Championships as a sprinter. He was an accomplished naval officer and nuclear engineer. He later earned an MBA. He had worked in the private sector. He had joined the CIA late in life, but quickly distinguished himself. John had infiltrated tribal groups in search of terrorists. In particular, he relentlessly pursued one terrorist assassin, with success. Later, he executed another covert action mission that spanned the globe, and he earned the Director's Medal for his accomplishment. John was, in fact, one of the most highly decorated officers in the CIA, but almost nobody knew anything about his success. So much of his work involved solo, offline operations, boxed in tight compartments because of the supreme sensitivity, that only a handful of the most senior officers were aware of his exploits. John rose through the ranks to assume field leadership positions. He was a small bundle of knotted, quick-twitch muscle, intellectual brilliance, managerial mastery, impeccable manners, and moral intensity. He was the precise engineer who loved every detail. He never forgot anything. He seldom lost his temper. He cared about everybody. He was so many of the things that I was not. He was the perfect complement, the perfect deputy. "That guy is a stud."